Hello, this is Bill Murray. I hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Hi, this is Jewel, wishing you a happy and healthy holiday.
A happy Hanukkah.
Hi, this is Boney James, wishing everybody a very Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year.
Hello, this is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Hi, this is Jay Seidel, hoping you're having a wonderful holiday.
Season greetings and best wishes for a joyous holiday.
And happy Groundhog Day.
You're listening to the Sounds of Christmas podcast.
Hi, I'm Ken Kessler, and welcome to the Sounds of Christmas podcast. If you're new to this podcast, I want to start by saying thanks for joining us. If you're not new, welcome back. Either way, I'm glad you're here. Now, to avoid any confusion, I want to start off by saying there won't be any music played here. This is a place for conversation. I'll talk about Christmas music and some related topics, sometimes by myself and sometimes with guests. If you're looking for music, just go to soundsofchristmas.com and click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page. We play the best variety of Christmas music all year long. Well, except in October, when we play the best variety of Halloween music. I'm very excited to have children's music performer and recording artist Suki Molloy with us on the podcast today. Hi, Suki.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've got a Christmas album that is just out, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I want to get everybody caught up to speed on who you are and what you're all about. And I saw on your website that you trained as a professional modern dancer in New York City, which is a big dream for a lot of people. You performed and toured. How did you go from that to children's music?
Yeah, well, it was a pretty interesting ride. I was injured, and it was clear that I needed to stop dancing. So I was faced with a major transition. And I had, in the back of my mind for a number of years, I kind of knew that I was interested in working with very young children. I hadn't really had a chance to explore that. And I also was certain that I really did not want to teach dance. But I was very interested in movement and how movement develops all the way from in utero through, you know, infants and then toddlers and preschoolers up into kindergarten. So I began to take that question, and I studied with Garland O'Quinn, who was an Olympic gymnast, went to West Point, and he had a PhD in child psychology and physical education. And that combination was very exciting to me.
Wow.
And I studied with Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen. And what I studied with her, she's an OT, is infant development. So I was kind of putting those things together, and I developed a program of movement activities, which ended up including song. And it became a Mommy and Me kind of gym and music program. And it all happened kind of, it just flowed. I didn't foresee any of it. And I was enjoying myself thoroughly. And then one of the parents said, you know, you're singing these songs. I'm familiar with the melodies, but not the lyrics. Couldn't you just like record one of the songs so I can play it at home? And I thought that over, and I thought, no, I'm just going to do a whole album, actually. And I was introduced to Larry Alexander, who's a Grammy-winning recording engineer, and it just happens that he lives in the next town. And that's kind of how the whole thing happened.
Yeah, for anybody who doesn't know the name Larry Alexander, you know people he's worked with. He's won Grammys. He's worked with Diana Ross, Bruce Springsteen, Willie Nelson, Bon Jovi, and David Bowie, just to name a few. Yep. So, wow. And he just happened to be nearby. That's amazing.
It really was. And he had never dealt with children's music. So this was kind of a new, fun direction for him. And I kind of knew that I had a singing voice because my mother was a singer. She actually managed a symphony orchestra. So I grew up around classical music my whole childhood. But I felt very shy about this. And I went into the first recording session with Larry, and he gave me a little disc to take home. And I listened to it, and I called him up and I said, thank you very much, but forget it. I sound terrible. I can't do this. And so he made me promise to come back in the next day so that he could prove to me that I could do this. And what he discovered is that if he would dance around in the studio looking kind of goofy and silly, so that I could remember that I was singing for children. And a different person came out of me, you know, something very essential that loves to be with children. And if he doesn't goof around in front of me, I don't do very well. And we are 7 albums later in this wonderful process.
And he still does that?
He still does it.
That's terrific. And you had, and I think you touched on this, you had launched your own Play, Move, and Sing program. And you do this for classes and workshops. What all is involved in that?
Well, so it's now just called, well, my company is Play, Move, and Sing, Inc., but it's just Circle Time with Suki Molloy. And it started, as I said, with infants, toddlers, and preschoolers developing and sharing movement and music activities in my own gym program. But then I went into nursery schools and daycare centers, even a few kindergartens, bringing this program. And the teachers would be interested because they saw that the children really became attracted to engage. Because I've never been interested in performing, because that's not really very much fun, to sit and look at somebody else having fun. So I realized that I wanted all the children and the adults in the room to be able to be standing up and dancing and moving, or playing with rhythm sticks or bells or maracas, and to make keep everything simple enough that developmentally I could tell, depending on the age group, how much to kind of indicate for them to try. So from there, and I had begun performing at this point from a circle song band, which now is the Suki Molloy and Friends. So I was beginning to perform in some theaters and libraries and public spaces. And it was the interest that the teachers were having that caught my interest. And so I thought, well, why don't I create a workshop series that could be for librarians and for preschool and toddler programs and schools to share what I had learned, because I had stumbled on a few very important principles about how movement develops. So I did that for several years, and it was very, very rewarding. And I should mention that the person I mentioned Garland O'Quinn, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had taken workshops with him, so I got to see him in action and the way that he one-on-one related with the children in front of him. And that was combined with Mr. Rogers, who I don't know how popular Mr. Rogers is today because he's pretty far in the past, but my children loved him. And he had said in an acceptance speech, for an award he received from PBS, that for him, and that's something that people could see online, is his acceptance speech. It was pretty extraordinary. But that for him, the 6 feet of space between the television screen and the child watching, that 6 feet of space he always felt was a sacred space. So whenever he went on the screen, he knew that he was in front of a young, impressionable being. And he always spoke directly with the children, even though he couldn't see them. And Gar O'Quinn was that way as well. So I wanted to model that and to know that every child in the room, and the parents too, at some point in the time that we spend together, it's 45 minutes or an hour, that they have the experience that they have been acknowledged. And that some way that I can offer a song or a movement or a play tool can help that child learn something about themselves, not something about me or their parents or something, but to have an experience of their own body and their own little being relating to an activity in the way they wish. So I offer and I model certain things, but I watch to see how the children interact on their own before I ask them to do what I'm doing. I want them to find their way into the experience that I'm trying to bring.
Are these training workshops that you do, are these recorded so teachers that are wherever across the country would be able to access them?
I did record several of them. I quite honestly can't remember if they're on my website, but it's a good point you're bringing up because there are a few. The issue with that is that they're public spaces, like, you know, a group of 75 librarians. I'm not at liberty.
Right.
But I have been asked, and since you're raising the question, maybe I can think about that toward the future. I would love to be able to share that way.
Yeah, I think because what you're talking about, I think, is so important, and I think it's terrific, but you can't be everywhere. And to be able to offer something like that up to teachers in Wyoming or Nebraska or California or Hawaii or wherever, I think that would be terrific.
Uh-oh, now you've got me on a whole new project.
I didn't mean to give you homework.
No, it's a good idea. It's a good idea, and I have thought about it.
You had mentioned Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
Who was had a big impact on me. I like to think that I'm a better person because of him. That doesn't mean that I'm a wonderful person, but that I'm better. He made me want to be better. And I know that you actually, or your child actually got to meet him.
Yeah, it's really something. And I just wanted to, let's see, I have two of his books here, and I could just say the titles of them. One is Life's Journeys, According to Mr. Rogers, Things to Remember Along the Way. And the other is The World According to Mr. Rogers, Important Things to Remember. And he's timeless.
Yeah.
And I hope the libraries, you know, have those books. Well, my husband and I, with our first son, I guess our second one must have been in a little, he was an infant. And so our son at that point was maybe between 4 and 5, our older son. And we were at Colonial Williamsburg. And I don't know if anyone listening has been there, but it's really wonderful. You just go back in time. And our son wanted to join the Colonial Army, and which you can do at Colonial Williamsburg. So you have a tri-cornered hat and a stick and a little outfit. And so he was marching along as a Colonial soldier. And up ahead, we noticed that there were some people walking backwards with, it was like a whole camera crew on wheels. And then we see horses, and then we realize that this is a horse-drawn wagon. And our son, James, just took off running toward this horse-drawn wagon, yelling at the top of his lungs, "Mr. Rogers!" So we took off running. And James, so Mr. Rogers sees and hears this child, and he's being filmed. You know, he's filming for a show. And he hears and sees this boy, and he stopped the camera crew. He had them stop the horse, the man who was up front with the reins. And he turned sideways, facing us. And James ran up the two steps into Mr. Rogers' arms, right on his lap. And so he asked us, you know, what is his name? We said James. And he talked to James for, you know, a half a minute or a minute. And it was the most remarkable thing to find out that somebody who you feel is a special human being turns out to be a real special human being. And then he said to James, "You know, James, I would love to stay here and talk with you longer. But see, I have this camera crew and the horses are all ready. So we're going to say goodbye and I'll see you next time." And James, happy as a clam, came down the two steps. We had to help him because they were tall steps. And Mr. Roger, just off he went, Mr. Rogers, with this horse-drawn wagon being filmed. And it was,
wow,
it was just the most wonderful thing. It really was.
And it's so nice to hear stories like that about Mr. Rogers. So nice. I want to get to the Christmas album, but there's one more thing. And we were talking before we started the podcast about animals. And I know that in addition to children, animals are a big thing for you, especially donkeys. How did that come about?
Well, all my life, I've loved music and wildlife. And I've been able to have a lot of both. And the short version of this is that I have a fair amount of experience with a lot of different kinds of animals, but I have never known donkeys. And I ride horses and stuff, but I've never known donkeys. And, you know, they have this reputation of being stubborn. People always talk about donkeys being stubborn. It turns out they're not. It's like a bad reputation. It's not true. So my husband used to say that, yes, you know, I'm stubborn. I'm just like a donkey. Well, we were traveling. It was near Christmas time. And I noticed a book in a bookstore called Running with Sherman by Chris McDougall. And there's this big donkey on the front. And I thought, well, this will be a funny gag gift I'll give my husband at Christmas. Well, he didn't read it. And then the very beginning of March, my husband, who is a doctor, became very, very ill with COVID. And he was hospitalized. We almost lost him. But he came home and he's fine. But the reason I'm telling you that is that for that week that he was in the hospital and I couldn't see him, I read Running with Sherman. I devoured this book. And that's how I fell in love with donkeys, and in particular, rescue donkeys. And in fact, rescue for all animals is something that humans are given the stewardship of animal life on this earth. And I wish we could do better. So it's been my hope that the adventures of Little Stubby could help open people's interest to donkeys, among other animals. So Sherman had been abused, and the author, Chris McDougall, his daughter really wanted a horse. He said, we can't do a horse. What about a donkey? And his daughter finds this decrepit thing that's near death. And they bring it home. And some people came who knew about donkeys. And they said, you know, this is, you're going to just have to put it out of its misery. Well, a goat that they had became the best friend of the donkey. And the goat lifted the donkey's spirits. And they had his hooves trimmed, and they fixed up his coat, and they got him to begin to eat. And then the author and owner of this donkey, Chris McDougall, is a runner. He wrote the book Born to Run. And someone told him, you need to get the donkey. The donkey has to have something to do. So Chris had this idea that he would run, not sit on the donkey, but run with the donkey. And so that's how this whole thing got started. And it came up repeatedly about how you get a donkey to do something that wasn't its idea. And that's when I began to realize that donkeys are not stubborn. They just require a certain level of trust and understanding of what's being asked of them so they can agree. And because they're desert animals, they're originally from the Mediterranean, it's very dry. They have like a peripheral vision that's very highly developed. So they have, it's like a scanning device. So they're always looking for snakes, anything that moves because of danger. So that's, they're not stubborn. They're very smart. So when I began, so Stubby, there are six stories. And what I recognized in reading about Stubby and other donkeys, and then I have visited a number of donkey rescue farms, that donkeys and children are very similar. And I wouldn't want any parent listening to take offense to this. I mean it in the sweetest, most positive way. When you win a donkey's trust, it's kind of a BFF forever. They're very affectionate. They're familial. A donkey family will stay together for 30 some odd years. They don't really like being alone. They're very fun. They like to play, but they require a certain kind of sensitivity in how you relate to them so that they can feel that trust and then do what you wish. And I see parents in all these classes that I teach, you know, it's time to go and the child has to put on the coat, child has to put on the shoes, child has to get in the stroller, child has to get in the car. And it's difficult for everybody, these transitions. And so one of the principles that I discovered in working with children and donkeys is that transitions are full-blown activities. So being sensitive to transitions and helping to have the child or the donkey, who's very childlike, have some say in the process. And Garland O'Quinn said something so brilliant to me once. He said, "Suki, have you ever heard about the three T's?" I said, "The three T's? No." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you. It's like this. Things take time. And if you have that as a mantra when you're with children, and you have that as a mantra when you're with a donkey, things will go quite well. It just may take more time." And so with the stories with Stubby, I wanted the stories to be helpful in some way to children. So the six stories are things that actually happened to me as a child, and I realized that they could be appropriate for a donkey. And one is learning to swim. Donkeys do not like water. They do not want to go in water. Going to the doctor for the first time. Well, a donkey has to have his hooves trimmed by the farrier. You know, they have to learn how to accept to be handled that way. Moving to a new home, you know, which is kind of scary. So there's six stories all together. And, you know, I didn't really want a talking donkey. So I tried to make it, you know, as a narrator that I'm kind of describing what he's experiencing. So that's the adventures of little Stubby. And I just yesterday signed a contract agreement with a publisher to make it into a book. So right now it's a recording, a storytelling album. And now it's going to be illustrated as a book. So I'm very, very excited.
That's terrific. I think a lot of people don't realize that there are all kinds of rescue farms and sanctuaries for lots of different animals. Yep. I mean, I have a rescue dog that I got, and I went to, this is the second one I've had. I went to a shelter for the first time 6, 7, 8 years ago and had no idea how they worked. And I met a dog who was at the time 11 years old, and nobody wanted an 11-year-old dog. There are families there looking for cute puppies. And I thought, well, how sad. So I adopted the dog. It was one of the most wonderful things I ever did. And he was with me for, I think, 3 years. And I spoiled him rotten.
Good.
And after I lost him, I needed a little time. But then I got another one 2-3 years ago. And he was completely different in that he had been abused and abandoned over and over. And it took time for him to trust me, for him to accept the new home. I'm now his only friend. He loves me. He doesn't much like anybody else, but he loves me. And it took, like you said, it took time. It took him trusting me to be able to go to the vet, to be able to do any of those things that a lot of people just take for granted. And I and the story that you're talking about with Stubby and the book that led you to that, I think those would be so important for people, whether for whatever you're doing, if animals are going to be part of your life, not to equate children and animals the same thing. So save your emails if you heard that. That's what you're thinking I said. But for anybody who is going to do that, you know, people give animals as Christmas presents. And it's not just a little gift. It's a living thing that needs time. And I think that that's so important. I'm very glad that you said that.
Well, the rescue farms, they're great because you can just Google what's in your area. And some are wildlife rescue. So, you know, it's going to be eagles and mountain lions and stuff like that. But you can sort of get a little more specific. But there's one that I go to, Little Long Ears, which is in Pennsylvania. And I go and spend a day or two, and I volunteer all day. So I get to be with the animals and raking hay and picking up poop, you know. And but they do have days when if they invite families to come and children have that exposure. And I wanted to mention there's a podcast, and Ken, maybe you know it. It's The Deal with Animals.
I've heard of it, yeah.
And I think she's like in 60 countries or something. And I recently interviewed with her, and I think for the second time, which is, you know, won't come out till January. But I'm bringing it up because she was interested in what's referred to as anthroposophical. So it's when you give human traits to an animal in order to make a point or have a story. And the question was how to, and of course, Disney, and we have lots of examples of that, but how that could be developed further into something that animals aren't necessarily just cute or stuffed toys or something, but how we could help children growing up, grow up with a feeling of for wildlife and for domestic animals, you know. I'm a vegetarian, so that was a decision I made, but not that people need to be vegetarian by any means, but that how to have stories that include animals or have animals as main characters, but help the child reader or listener understand more about what life is really like on a farm, for instance. And I had not thought of it until she and I had this conversation. But she does a great deal to help animals all over the world. And there are countries, and I have been in them, where animals are definitely not treated the way we treat them here. And it just, what can I say?
It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. And again, the correlation I make with children and animals is that when I look into the eyes of an animal, my cats or a friend's dog or a deer. I ended up right in front of a deer a few days ago, and we just looked into each other. And to me, they just look so childlike and innocent. Yes, they have to eat, and some of them have to eat other creatures. You know, that's how things are, and it's hard to take. But there's a quality of innocence that I see in very young children. And, you know, how as parents and teachers and caregivers can we help a child and ourselves get to know that more innocent part so that it doesn't get so covered over? I don't know if I'm making sense, but
yeah,
I question.
I wish I was smart enough to be able to give you an answer.
There isn't one.
Yeah.
But it's having the question. It's
right.
Having the question in front of a child or a puppy. It's just having the question. And sometimes it helps us see a little differently.
Well, I know for me, and I don't mean to shrink it all down to a dog, but that's really, that's my frame of reference. And I know when I went to the shelter, I went to the shelter the first time with my wife, and they had so much information about the dog that I adopted that I was interested in adopting. And I was just so amazed that a family could have a dog for 10 years or more and then decide that that was enough and they would dump it at the shelter. I couldn't wrap my brain around that.
It's just heartbreaking.
It is. And I couldn't wait to bring him home and give him a new family. And my wife had to stop me because I was ready to put my name on the list for, you know, like a dozen other dogs and bring them all home. And it's a nice sentiment, but I just can't do that. And I may not be able to save the world, but I made a difference in that dog's world. And that feels good. And it feels good to know that the one that I have now, who is more difficult because of the traumatic things he's been through, but I've made a difference for him and I've given him something good and a safe place. And that's a good feeling too. And it's just, I don't know. I would like to, I love animals and I would love to be able to save them all, but I can't. But I feel like if I can talk about it a little bit and give somebody else the idea, maybe some other people might do it too, and we'll start making a difference.
Well, even little, you know, small donations go a long way. And there's a community that was just, I live in New York, there's a community in Brooklyn. Because there are something like, 100,000 strays or something in Brooklyn. Wow. And so this group of people, one neighborhood got together and they've created a shelter. And the city is helping, but it's mostly donations and people volunteering. But they want to get these cats off the streets, so they have to neuter them. And, you know, but this small group of people, a small neighborhood in Brooklyn, is making this major difference. So we can do things, you know. It's not easy, but we can do things.
Right. We could continue down this path for a long time.
Yeah.
I know people who are listening going, I thought you were going to talk about Christmas music. I do want to mention that, you know, we've talked about lots of nice things and things that you have worked on. And Suki has some amazing credentials, and I just want to rattle off a few of them here. Honored with Parents' Choice, Children's Music Web, Preferred Choice, Creative Child, Mom's Choice Awards, and National Parenting Products Award winner. So I probably should have introduced you with that, but I wanted everybody to sort of get to meet you and know you, and then I wanted to say that, you know, you know, she talks about a lot of nice stuff, but it's not just talk. So I did want to mention that. How did you get from all of this stuff that we've talked about to deciding to do a Christmas album?
Well, it had been on my mind for a while. So I have the one storytelling album, The Adventures of Stubby, but I have five, I think, other albums. I've sort of lost track. Five Little Oysters, I Am Sleepy, I Am Happy, I Don't Remember. They're all on iTunes and all those places, but Spotify and everywhere. And so primarily, I either write my own music and lyrics. I play the piano and the auto harp. And or I take traditional tunes like The Ants Go Marching and Skip to Maloo, you know, tunes that we would recognize. And then create lyrics to those songs to fit the aim of what I'm trying in that in singing that or bringing that activity to a group. And always when it comes around holiday time, I end up playing Jingle Bells and I Have a Little Dreidel and Oh Hanukkah and Santa Claus is Coming to Town and Kwanzaa is Here. And everyone gets so excited. And of course, living in New York, this is a melting pot of people from all cultures and races and religions. And I've been aware early on that I need to respect and honor each family's way that they celebrate. And a few years ago, I gave a concert. It was actually a free concert. And it was a winter holiday concert because I wanted to be inclusive of everyone. So we had it sort of kind of early December to cover as many winter holidays as we could. And it was so special to see everyone on their feet singing and dancing to, whether it was Jingle Bells or O Hanukkah or a Kwanzaa song, that we all participated together and were celebrating together. Now, there's also the solstice, and I think there's Ramadan, but I had to limit myself to three. So in the idea of this album, I wasn't sure that I could pull it off, but I was determined to do it. And perhaps people who celebrate Christmas don't want to hear Hanukkah songs. People who celebrate Hanukkah don't want. But I thought, well, look, where we live, the way we live now, you don't have to buy an album. Yeah. You know, you can just stream or download whatever songs you wish. But of course, it's my hope that everyone would love to listen to all of them. So that was the impulse. So I went to Larry with this idea, and he was very interested immediately. And what was difficult is that these are songs that exist. So I'm not writing them. And some of them I had to purchase licenses for, because some are public domain and traditional, others are not. But needing to see how to fit ourselves into these very well-known songs that very famous people have sung. And it was a challenge, but it was really wonderful. And we're both very excited and happy about where it landed. I think it's a lot of fun to listen to.
I think so too. And I love that Grammy-winning producer Larry Alexander, who worked with Rock and Roll Hall of Fame royalty,
yeah,
didn't just produce this, he's playing on it
all the way through. So Larry, we co-produce, I forgot to mention that, all the albums. Yeah, Larry plays percussion, he's a good percussionist, and he's a very good bass player. And then of course we deal with arranging, so all kinds of arrangements. Larry is just, he's a genius. And sound effects, and he also plays guitar. It's not even sort of all jumping into my brain here. And then on the album, which the title is Snow Is Falling, is Steven Benson, who plays a lot on Broadway. And Steven plays guitar and mandolin and banjo, and he always walks into the studio with like six or seven instruments. Steven lives in New York, and he also does a lot of freelance work, plays with the Big Apple Circus band. And then on violin is Chris Cardona, who lives locally. And Chris was the fiddler in Fiddler on the Roof. So he was the one who stood on the roof for 4 years of shows.
Wow.
So he's, you know, on Broadway a lot. And then Axel Belahobic, who's quite a gifted pianist and keyboard player. And he can play anything on the keyboard, a clarinet, a flute. And also, finally, Larry's wife, Melissa Alexander, who's a concert pianist. And she did a couple of the keyboard pieces that were a little bit out of my depth. So I play piano, but I struggle on the electric keyboard. So that's who's on it.
Wow. It's an amazing team for anybody who thinks, oh, it's another Christmas record and want to dismiss it. Wow. This is an amazing team. And you've got 18 songs on this, on Snow Is Falling.
Right.
And I feel like as you're putting this together and thinking of the songs, you probably had a list like of 100.
Yes, it was difficult to figure out which ones, but it sort of began to be clear as we went along, you know, what they were going to be. And of course, some of them I knew from childhood, so I had certain attachment myself.
And I mean, I'm not going to go through and count to make sure that, you know, was that actually a concern that you wanted to have a certain number of Hanukkah songs or a certain number of Kwanzaa so everybody would be happy? Or did you just sort of roll with it?
Well, you know, you're bringing this up, and of course, it was a question all along. So we ended up with more Christmas than the others because that's my orientation. So, you know, those are the ones I knew. And then I believe there are 6 Hanukkah songs. I think that's right. And 2 Kwanzaa songs. And the Hanukkah songs, I spoke with some of my friends who celebrate Hanukkah, and Larry celebrates Hanukkah. And I had 2 favorites that I had been singing over the years. But I discovered that Pete Seeger wrote Hanukkah songs.
Really?
Yes. And I love, no, excuse me, not Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie.
Okay.
Woody Guthrie, okay. And that I think it, I can't remember what this exactly was, but it's either his daughter married into a family that celebrated the Jewish holidays, or his daughter's stepmother. There was some connection. So he began to do this for his daughter and his grandchildren. Oh, I just love Woody Guthrie. And so 2 of the songs are his, and they're less familiar to people. And I thought, why not? You know, let's bring it on. And also with a few of the Christmas songs we did as instrumentals, and some of them perhaps are a little less familiar, but were kind of close to my heart. So I, you know, it was a question whether to have 6, 6, and 6. And I perfectly understand that that would be the reasonable, logical, right thing to do. But I also had to go with my own attraction, my own childhood simultaneously. But I feel that what we brought, also interestingly, you know, I've never understood this, Ken, but Jingle Bells and Sleigh Ride, and there's a third one, there's no mention of Christmas whatsoever.
Right.
So, like, they're just associated with it, but they're really songs, they're songs from winter scenes.
Yeah.
Let's say, you know, when I really thought about that, I thought, wow, how did that happen?
Yeah, it's funny.
And Frosty. Frosty was the 4th one.
I think I wrote a blog a few years ago about Christmas songs that weren't really Christmas songs. And Jingle Bells is I think Jingle Bells was almost like a Thanksgiving song, almost like To Grandmother's House We Go.
Yes.
But it just kind of got caught up in the holiday. And after decades, I feel like, well, who am I to say that it's not a Christmas song? Because obviously it is now. It may not have started out that way, but it is now. But you're right. There's no mention of Christmas or Santa or reindeer or anything like that.
Sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling.
Yeah.
No mention of Christmas.
No.
And Frosty, but so, you know, it was my hope that we could listen to these all together as a whole album, as we're celebrating all around the same time. And Kwanzaa happens right after Christmas. And those songs were really interesting and fun to look for and to bring our own arrangements to. So, and that's something, by the way, the arrangements, I just think Larry had a great time. We had a great time with the arrangements.
I'm not familiar with the title song, Snow is Falling.
It doesn't exist until now.
Okay.
So it's to the tune of Frère Jacques. And I just came up with the words. I was on stage, and I had about 100 white translucent scarves. And we had made these big, huge snowballs. It was really wonderful. And I was just tossing these white scarves on stage. And then I had a large white translucent scarf that I was playing peekaboo with the audience. And it came to me just to sing, snow is falling all around. And so I do that in classes with the children with these white scarves, and we toss the snow. And then we bring out little plastic shovels and we shovel the snow on the rug. So that was the one song that I wrote the lyrics for on the album.
And I would imagine that children love that.
Well, playing that way, and it's a challenge in concert, you know, when you have a sizable audience, to get everyone to feel that they're participating, but it's really possible to do. And again, I never thought it was any fun to sit still and watch somebody else do something, unless it's a magic trick, that's a little different, but finding ways to include everyone so everyone feels that they've been a participant.
Seems like to me that like, this would be a great album to play while the family's decorating the tree. And I know that decorating the tree is not a Hanukkah or a Kwanzaa thing, but just as an example, a family activity like that for the holidays, that this would be something great to put on because I think everybody would enjoy it.
Well, it's also, children play this dreidel game at Hanukkah. You can have, does everyone know that song? I have a little dreidel, I made it out of clay. And when it's dry and ready, then dreidel, I shall play. And I do that with young kids too. But you know, there's also making crafts and making cards and decorating candles and lighting candles. And we can have music to listen to through all of these activities together, making food and putting on pajamas, taking a bath. We can bring music into our lives, and particularly around holidays. Why not include more holidays? And we can all learn about each other.
I think this is a terrific collection. And I hope that anybody who's listening, whether you have children or whether you were a child, I think you'll enjoy this. So what's up next for you? I know that's a tough one after you just had this album come out.
Well, now, because of you, I'm going to be looking at a project of trying to bring some of this teaching skills, possibly as some sort of video series or something, or just on my website. But I mentioned sort of at the beginning, I create art with felt. So I have picture books and things that, you know, are out there. I haven't done much to promote them, but I use felt boards when I'm teaching and also on stage. So little felt boards that every child in the room can have, or a 6-foot felt board that I can create Frosty the Snowman on stage with everyone telling me where the pieces go. But so it occurred to me that I could use my felt art for picture books, which is how that got started. So as I was creating the Stubby album, which is just storytelling with music behind it, you know, that Larry and I composed. And I realized, well, this could really be either 6 books or 1 book or 2 books. So I pitched it, and I've pitched my picture books around in the past, and they're typically just using the lyrics from songs. So this was something really different, storytelling. And lo and behold, Brandy Lane Belle Isle Books expressed interest, and we just got the green light. We're going to do it. So that will come out in about a year. So, and we'll start work on it next month. And this is, you know, be a very different process for me, but I I'm very excited about it. And I continue teaching. I don't teach very much anymore, but I still have one or two places that I teach a week.
Do you think there's a chance that you will revisit maybe Snow is Falling Part 2 or Snow is Still Falling or something like that?
Well, I'll have to see what Larry thinks. I don't know. You know, we really combed over the songs, but now that you've, this is not good, Ken. You keep giving me ideas.
I didn't mean to keep giving you homework. Sorry.
But, you know, we could. It's a thought. It's a thought. But we need a lot of people to purchase the music so that we can afford to make more music. So that's an ongoing dilemma for recording artists at this point.
Certainly. Well, I'll put a link down in the show notes so people who are listening to this can just click on that and go find Snow is Falling and buy a copy for everybody they've ever met. What's the best way for people to keep up with you? Is it through your website?
Well, website, Facebook, Instagram. I'm told that my distributor has put me on TikTok. I have never gone to find out, so I have no idea what's there. I'm all over YouTube. And then, of course, you know, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Pandora, that whole long list of streaming and download sites. People would probably love to visit the website because on the menu, there are different drop downs. And one is you can see video of me reading stories out loud, of my own books that come from the songs that I've recorded. There's another one of Craft Time with Suki, where I'm showing you how to create felt crafts with very young children. And the third one is a Circle Time, where I'm showing you some of the activities that we've been talking about in this program. And all of that stuff is on YouTube. But I think if you start with the website, then you can go to my YouTube channel. What else do people do? Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah,
and all that stuff. I see those links are on there, so I'll put a link to your website down in the show notes too, and everybody can find you and decide what they're interested in and go from there.
And if people want to subscribe, that always helps. Oh, and you can email me anytime through the website. So I love to hear from people and to talk with you. And so I invite you to go to the contact page and drop me a line and we can talk.
Very nice. Suki, thanks so much for spending so much time with us today and being patient to answer all my questions.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be asked, and it's an honor that all of those who are listening have the interest and the time to give. And I'm wishing everyone a very, very special winter holiday season.
And thank you so much for listening and for continuing to support the Sounds of Christmas station and podcast. I already told you how to listen to the station, and you're already listening to the podcast, so my work here is just about done. All of our episodes are available on the Sounds of Christmas website. Just click the podcast tab. We also have a Linktree page so you can find us on your favorite streaming site, and then you can subscribe and you'll never miss another episode. And I'll put links for that down in the show notes as well. If you have comments or suggestions on this episode, previous episodes, or the Sounds of Christmas station, feel free to reach out to me on social media or through the website. Thanks again. And may you always believe in Santa Claus.